And a good Sunday afternoon. In fact, it's scary good. It's like 65 degrees. It's not so good necessarily for the early part of January, but here we are inside still at WPVM 103.5. And it's time for Wordplay. I'm your host, Jeff Davis. And we've got a slightly different kind of show today. We're at the end of November. Thomas Rancrow and Nan Watkins dropped by the studio and we recorded an interview, so we're going to listen to that. The interview is about their new book, Rare Birds, which features interviews, very, very insightful interviews with musicians. So we're actually going to do something a little bit different, which is not that different here on Wordplay. We're actually going to listen to some of the music by the artist whom Thomas and Nan interviewed. So, without further ado, Thomas, how did this book come around?
Long shaggy dog story, to try to make a long story short. Several years ago, 15 to be exact, I undertook the journey of trying to make a living as a freelance writer, to try to, you know, make a living as a writer.
Radical.
Yes, a mistake. but anyway, I did, and I'd been working at Silver Herald and Silver, the newspaper there, and got laid off, and so I had some time, and the idea was to try to make my living as a writer, so I embarked on, you know, trying to connect with freelance writing gigs and jobs, and ended up connecting with Tom Patterson, who was at the time the editor of the Arts Journal.
All right.
And Tom and I got to talking, and one of the things we decided to try to do to utilize my time and would-be talents is to go down to Spoleto and to cover Spoleto, the Spoleto USA Festival in Charleston every summer. So I started my freelance, the freelance part of my life, doing that, really, and would go down and watch events, performances, do reviews, do articles, and also do interviews with some of the performers. And during the years that I did that every year, I interviewed musicians, dancers, writers, you know, a whole gamut of people in the different art forms. And so, long story short, you know, many years later, I have a whole collection of interviews with world-class musicians that I'd interviewed at the Spoleto Festival, just sitting around in my study, gathering dust. They'd all been published in one place or another, but I decided to try to compile them and try to find a way to create a book scenario from those interviews.
Yeah, great. So, let's see, the Arts Journal was in its heyday back in the 70s and 80s. So these interviews, most of them go back, 20 years now?
Well, the early ones do.
Yeah?
We still go down to Spoleto. We don't do it every year. You know, Nan and I have been, you know, we got the idea to kind of make it a work vacation, you know, at some point. And we'd go down and do a couple of interviews, see a couple of shows, but enjoy being in Charleston for a few days. Yeah. It goes back to the late 80s, and then the more recent interviews are, you know, I think the last one we did was somewhere around 2000.
Uh-huh. So that's pretty recent, yeah. Well, great. Just out of curiosity, do you have the interviews on tape, or did you record them by hand? Did you take notes? How did you do the interviews?
Both. I usually try to, try to record interviews, but I'm always taking notes at the same time.
Yeah.
Just in case the technology doesn't work
quite right. And
which usually happens.
Yeah.
More often than not, anyway. And but I have one of these little micro recorders with the micro tapes, and so all of these interviews are on tape. Some of them are almost inaudible, but I tell you, after you've done many interviews and have done the transcribing of interviews from especially microtape, it's tedious to say the least. But we
tedious work.
We got through it, and the interviews all got onto paper and now into book form.
Yeah, and they're fascinating interviews. I mean, you get they're much more up close and personal than the average arts publication interview. I mean, you get. I think you must have left in, you know how it works in interviews. There are always meanders, and you left those in. You didn't straighten them out, you know.
No, I think in a lot of cases that's where the action is. And yeah, that's what I wanted, you know. I mean, anybody can go in and ask somebody about their latest CD or mm-hmm. you know, all the obvious kind of journalistic kinds of things,
5-minute interview.
I was more interested in, you know, going deeper with these guys and girls and finding out what makes them tick and a little bit about their history and their spiritual journeys and mm-hmm. all the rest. So we got some pretty candid information during the interviews, and some I think is very unique and even interesting. Interviews.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah.
Out of the ordinary.
Indeed.
Hopefully.
Indeed. Well, why don't you read us a little bit of one of the interviews or two of the interviews or whatever?
Well, I'll read you just little pieces and parts of a couple things. Just. To give folks an idea of what we're talking about.
Yeah, what kind of material we got here.
One of my favorite interviews was with Charles Lloyd, the soprano sax player, who's often been compared to Coltrane. When I was living in San Francisco, well, let me just read this to you because this is what I say. When I was living in San Francisco during the 1970s, I kept hearing the name of Charles Lloyd, as if he were Northern California's best-kept secret. There was a kind of mystical association with the stories I heard surrounding the music and life of this man. The picture that I had conjured in my mind from hearing these stories was of a wandering monk musician. Myth had it that with a backpack full of ancient and esoteric wind instruments, he would sometimes just appear at events or gatherings to wow the crowd into reverie and trance. There didn't seem to be enough superlatives to describe Charles Lloyd, coming from those who told their stories of personal encounters with this shaman flutist. I seemed to always arrive just where he had just been in those days, a day too late, never having the chance to hear him play. It wasn't until some years later that I actually heard his music. I was recuperating from a near-fatal automobile accident, and a friend had sent me a tape to listen to while convalescing. "Music to Heal By," she had written in the accompanying note. The tape was Pathless Path by Charles Lloyd. To make a long story short, I loved the calming meditational essence of the recording, and in my mind at least, I considered my time spent listening to Pathless Path as an important part of my recovery process. At that time, Lloyd's most ethereal recording became one of my favorite collections of recorded music, and I would have to say it is still one of my favorites today. So, in the summer of 1997, when I had the chance to finally attend a Charles Lloyd concert, I was more than ready to drive 300 miles to hear him play. A live outdoor concert held in the Cistern at the College of Charleston was the perfect setting for a Charles Lloyd event. An open courtyard surrounded by 19th century architecture under the moss-laden branches of the old Spanish oaks on a perfectly quiet, moon-fed night. Lloyd's music on that evening, as performed by his quartet, from the very outset with his concert opener, The Blessing, was reverential, if not transfixing. By the end of The Blessing, I knew I was in for a treat. So that was the part of the introduction to my interview with Charles, and most of the introductions are very similar to that. They're mm-hmm. a little personal story of how the interview took place, where, when, and some of the context.
Like a production note for the...
Right.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And so, but then the interview starts this way. I'll just read just a little bit.
All right.
I ask him, "Last night when you took the stage for the concert at the Cistern at the College of Charleston, the big clock on the old building behind the stage just stopped. I was, for whatever reason, watching it and was aware that it had stopped. Given the nature of your performance, the spiritual and uplifting quality of the pieces you performed, I felt that somehow there had to have been a connection between your music and the fact that the clock had stopped. The energy of the evening was indeed as if time was standing still, perhaps emphasizing the idea that what you are doing, or at least trying to do, is timeless." And Charles Lloyd responds, "No, I wasn't aware that the clock stopped when we took the stage last night, but that's a good place to start. For time doesn't really exist anyway." So you can see right away we're getting into deep water with Charles.
Right, right. Moving right along.
Which is where he Which is where he lives.
Where he lives anyway, yeah. Right. Yeah, he's just living in the deep water.
At least on a certain level of life, perhaps in a relative sort of way, there is time. But when the music is happening, it sort of removes the time. The Buddha, in terms of right mindfulness, speaks about the qualities of nowness. There is only the now, he says. And so if the clock stopped, as you say, then that was quite a benediction. Then I ask him, your album Pathless Path has always been something of a signature piece for me, even though it has been largely ignored by the so-called serious music critics. In terms of this musical and spiritual path of yours, where do you see it as beginning? And Charles Lloyd responds, ever since the beginning, since I was born into this world, there have been things that I've been unable to understand, like how I got dropped off into Memphis. Like they say, be careful how to choose your parents. And he laughs. But when I look back at, in terms of my early contact with prophets, it's very beautiful. There was this source thing. There was this real elixir of and essence of musicality. There was this young genius, Phineas Newborn, who was like a young Art Tatum and very inspirational during my early years. Newborn and music became like my religion. I saw this in the great music makers. I saw them as sages and saints. I saw them as transforming reality, as making a better world as a result of what they did musically. I've known since the time I was 3 that I was to be a music maker. I was in a hot spot of something special going on with this indigenous art form of so-called jazz. And since the beginning, I've always been moved by that.
Nice, yeah. I always liked Lloyd's work, but and I enjoyed your interview with him a lot. It really gave new dimensions to what I was hearing.
He's a deep fella, and the stories about the interview are probably just as almost as interesting as the interview itself. You know, he was. I interviewed him while him and his wife packed to go to Europe for a European tour, and amidst the chaos and melee of people toting bags and equipment and all kinds of stuff, trying to catch a plane that they were late for, he was able to give me an incredibly clear and insightful, incisive interview.
Yeah.
You know, so it's amazing.
Very mindful.
Yeah.
You know, just there.
Yeah, yeah. In the midst of chaos comes this brilliance, you know, and clarity. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Well, that's great. That's great. Here's some Charles Lloyd. You're listening to Wordplay on WPVM 103.5, the progressive voice of the mountains. And that was Charles Lloyd playing The Blessing, probably the longest musical track that I've ever played here on Wordplay. But he works in long form, so what can you do? Has a complex structure. Now back to our interview with Thomas Raincrow and Nan Watkins. Fine, they're fine interviews. I mean, this has clearly been a labor of love on your part. I mean, this is something that, you know, as you've been so prolific in the last 2 years. I mean, you've got a book out on environmental issues. You've got a book out of interviews with musicians. You know, another book of poetry that came out just last year. And you say you've got another book of poetry coming out very soon in French. So you've been a busy guy. But and I've enjoyed all these projects, but this is the one that, for me, partly, I guess, because of my own love of music, struck, you know, really close to the bone. I really enjoyed it a lot. So, yeah.
Well, it was fun to do, and like I say, it's all part of the process. I know Nan would definitely agree with that. She's a process person. I tend to be more of a result person or a destination person, mm-hmm. and whereas Nan really enjoys the journey.
The journey is the prize.
Right.
Yes.
And
yes.
And so, I mean, I was coming into all these interviews with really a literary bent, more mm-hmm. or less, than anything mm-hmm. else. I mean, I've always loved music and was knowledgeable to some extent about music and jazz and modern composition. But when Nan and I started going down together, it really allowed that musical. I mean, Nan's background is in classical piano
right.
and performance piano, and
right.
She knows classical music inside out and backwards, and is can talk the talk.
Right.
So,
right. Which is a language all in itself.
Exactly.
It
so
is.
When Nan's in the room when we're doing these interviews, it's like Thomas Crowe didn't hardly exist when they got into conversations about music,
uh-huh.
and we got into some really, really interesting and in-depth conversations about music that I couldn't have brought to the table
right.
Just because I don't know the language.
Right. I mean, can you hear the difference between a fifth and a minor seventh?
So
whatever those are.
So when Nan and I started going down together, the dynamics of the interviews changed and the experiences
yeah.
changed. And so the interviews, as they appear in the book, have a different feel and have it's a triple voice. It's, you know,
yeah.
Nan and I asking the questions, and then the interview with the musician. So
yeah.
it's three dimensional instead of two. Maybe you could
yeah.
say.
Yeah, that's good. It's so, you know, if I were going to be interviewing a musician, I would definitely need a musician along as an interpreter, basically.
Well, I had the good fortune to have that opportunity, and having said that. Well,
why don't we hear a little bit
from Nan? Move the microphone over and let Nan say a few words.
Nan, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yeah, it's great to have you here. Yeah. So, how did these interviews go for you? You were able to speak to these guys as guys and gals, as a musician, as somebody who actually understood what musicians think about all the time.
Right. Well, it was fun, and it was also fun to be there with Thomas, because in some cases, the people were doing things with both words and with music. For instance, Philip Glass, he would be doing an opera production, and so you would have the literary side of it as well as the musical side, and you would begin and talk about the literature, and I would be in there coming in. And Philip Glass, we can talk about him for a minute, because
yeah.
I came along for a second interview. Thomas had already interviewed him once
uh-huh.
When they were doing Hydrogen Jukebox with Allen Ginsberg down
oh, yeah.
at the Charleston Spoleto Festival. And
uh-huh.
then I came along for the second one, and we and gauged a moment or an hour of Philip Glass's time. He's also
wow.
one of these very
right.
busy people
right.
out in a courtyard of a hotel
huh.
down there. It was, of course, a balmy early summer day
uh-huh.
in Charleston, so it was plenty warm. And we were sitting out there talking, and once you get Philip started, he goes on and on and on. So yeah. he's bright and just full of energy and full of ideas, and one idea just sparks another one. So I began my questioning by asking him, in a nutshell, what was it like when he was studying in Paris with Nadia Boulanger? So he discussed that. And then toward the end of the interview, after we had talked about various things that he had done in his career, I asked him again for a nutshell version of what he had done toward the end of his life. And if you want, I'll just read a little section of that.
Please share that.
And here is my question. I begin with that. One final question to try to tie this all together. Since we began with the question of Boulanger and your nutshell response to that part of your life, I'd like to ask where you find yourself today with regard to composition and the kind of music you are composing currently as compared with, say, your early work. What has or does define those differences? Has there been a major development over the arc of your personal and professional history? And Philip Glass answers, again, in a nutshell, as you say, the happiest development has been my ability to collaborate with other artists. This is something that I have learned to do over the years. And then parenthetically, looking at and making an aside to Thomas Crowe, he says, this is probably not something that I would have said to you in 1990, right? And Thomas says, not that I remember. And Philip Glass continues, what has grown over the years in my is my appetite for collaboration, and as well, I think, even my skills at knowing how to bring people together. This includes knowing how to give ample room to someone in order that they can do their work, knowing how to delegate certain areas of work to other people, knowing how not to be a control freak and a tyrant, to allow any kind of collaborative partnership to be a joyful experience for all concerned, to allow even the possibility of love to become part of that experience. This means being vulnerable, being willing to be flexible with your ideas, maybe even giving up your ideas in order to let the other person work in their capacity or to explore their own ideas. Do you see what I mean? Two words come to mind here, synthesis and synergy. In fact, the synergy of artists coming together is so much greater than the ideas, the images, or the visions that I bring individually into a piece. The truth of the matter is that I'm dependent upon the talents of other artists to do what I do. The fact of this demands that I have learned over the years the skills of cooperation. And I think that's a big point coming from a man who is really one of the best known of our, you'd have to call him, classical musicians today. Mm-hmm. And he does a tremendous amount of work in film work and theater work and his own symphonic work and so on. But he's admitting very openly that he couldn't possibly do it without a great deal of collaboration from others and enjoying the very artistic input of other people. He's not trying to steal the show for himself.
And as he mentioned himself, he probably wouldn't have said that in 1990, because, I mean, early on he was known as a kind of auteur.
That's right.
It's a real opening up for him.
So there, by asking him the question of development, I think it was an interesting thing that he centered in on that right away.
Yeah.
Sometimes reminds me, I was telling Thomas the other day, of what Andy Warhol did in his factory. I mean, it's the two, of course, are very different in other ways, but just the idea that these artists are working on a scale where they're highly dependent upon others, as many artists have worked throughout history. It's not, you know, the artist isn't always the lonely guy in the garret.
He often
has to.
Those are only the poets.
Right. But we're not talking about poets here. We're talking about musicians. Oh, no. Yeah. Thank you.
That's Eugene Friesen doing Cove. You're listening to Wordplay, and today it's Wordplay and Musical Play as well on WPVM 103.5, the Progressive Voice of the Mountains, broadcast service of the Mountain Area Information Network. Back to our interview now with Thomas Raincrow and Nan Watkins. Anything else we can say about this book? What would you like to for folks to know about it?
While we're talking about Philip Glass, I might as well just mention that the title of the book is Rare Birds, Conversations with Music Legends. And the title came from the initial conversation that I had with Philip Glass, where he uses the phrase epiphany as a rare bird. And he was talking about how rare it is to have true epiphanies
as an
artist.
Yeah,
those peak moments, or when you're in the zone, or however you want to describe them, where something really crystallizes that is unique, at least to yourself. And so I always like that phrase, epiphany is a rare bird, and I like the idea of that as a title, in the sense that these interviews with the six people that we've selected for the book really represent a collection of rare birds. These are people that are very different from each other, but are very unique and groundbreaking in their own ways. Mm-hmm. I mean, they really, you know, set the tone for a lot of what happens in their own musical genres and worlds. And in that sense, I think the book is a little bit, hopefully will be seen as being a little bit unique and important, even maybe for musicologists and fans of jazz and contemporary classical music.
Yeah. Who are the other artists who are included in the book other than Charles Lloyd and Philip Glass?
Right. Well, it's those two, and then Steve Reich, which is also a well-known
minimalist composer,
The Steve Reich interview was the last one that Nan and I did, also at Spoleto. Eugene Friesen, the cello player for the Paul Winter Consort.
Right, and a great composer in his own right.
And very unique and groundbreaking in a lot of ways, although maybe not everybody knows who he is. Mm-hmm. He's not Yo-Yo Ma, but he's doing something very different.
Yeah.
Working in a different musical universe. And Sotoma B. Benjamin, who is, in my mind, one of the most interesting and probably one of the greatest jazz songstresses of the last 50 or more years. Yeah. Another person who doesn't have the reputation of Billie Holiday or Diana Washington, but who is every bit as talented. And she's the wife of Abdullah Ibrahim, who is also interviewed in the book, from Cape Town, South Africa. Both of them were discovered by Duke Ellington, oddly enough, in Switzerland, and back in the early 60s, and they made their first recordings in Paris with Duke Ellington producing and directing the whole session with Billy Strayhorn on pianos and all. I mean,
good company to be in.
Yes. And basically, it made Abdullah Ibrahim's career, that first album, in Paris.
That's the Abdullah Ibrahim Trio doing Barakat.
The story of Sodoma B. Benjamin's a little sadder in the sense that they also recorded her first album during that session, singing mostly jazz standards, but with the backing of Billy Strayhorn and Al Dooley Abram and Duke Ellington and the whole cast of greats. But then they lost the master recording, and it was lost for 30 years.
Did they really lose the tape?
Well, that's the whole conspiracy theory side of the conversation, but 30 years later it appears and is produced and won all the huge jazz music awards in France and this kind of thing.
They found the original session.
They found the original session and it remixed and mastered it and distributed it, and it won all kinds of awards.
Right. Well, A Morning in Paris.
Yeah. A fabulous, fabulous album, and I've included my review of the album when it came out that same year. But Nan should really talk more about Sodoma B. Benjamin. She's a very interesting person, and Nan connected with her early on and spent time with her. Actually went to New York and hung out with her a little bit and really did the real legwork for the interview and knows her, you know, in a more intimate way than I do.
Well, let's hear about that.
Well, Sodoma is really quite a personality, and I went to meet her in the Chelsea Hotel, where she and Abdullah have lived for many years. I can't remember how long, but they virtually raised their son and their daughter there, both of whom are musicians in their own right. And when I went up to the desk, of course, everybody knew who Sodoma was, and there was no problem at all finding her. But she didn't want me to come up there. Her son was working on some drumming or something that morning. So instead, she took me to a kind of dive nearby, a little diner sort of thing. And she had brought with her her daughter's Walkman and some old tapes, and we're sitting there eating a late morning breakfast in this this little diner that smells of fried potatoes and eggs and so on. And she hauls it out and she said, "Now I want you to listen to this." And she had some other old Strayhorn tapes that had just surfaced. That's why I say I wonder what happens to some of these tapes that were recorded 40, 50 years ago and they don't surface. Right. And she plunked it into the little Walkman and handed me the headphones, and I'm sitting there listening to Billy Strayhorn, and she's talking on and on about her time then, and could not say enough about Duke Ellington. Mm-hmm. And what he did at every turn. I mean, he was the one who brought Abdullah to the Newport Jazz Festival, and that was his first launch in the United States. Yeah. He helped them find a place to live. He just was like a kind of sponsor at every stage of the game, and she thought the world of him. Said he was the most elegant guy, and
real generosity of spirit too. I mean, he was apparently. I mean, helped Django Reinhardt, you know, et cetera, find
that's
audience
it.
Here.
That's
played,
it.
Played a tour with him.
And the way she described meeting them, remember, it was a February night in Zurich, and Ellington had come through to play in one of the large concert halls in Zurich, Switzerland, and Abdullah had been playing with his little band in, I think it was called the Jungle Club or something in Zurich. It was a club that they brought African musicians in.
Yeah.
And they were playing, and she ran through the snowy streets of Zurich to see Ellington after his concert, and she went back and must have had a very pleading look on her face because she asked the great man if he would be willing to follow her through the streets to listen to her husband. She had no thoughts about herself at that time. And so he said, "Why, yes, I will do that." And he came through and asked Abdullah to play with his, I think it was a trio at the time, and he did. And then finally he turned to Sodoma and said, "Are you the manager?" And she said, "No, no." He said, "Well, do you perform?" And she said, "Well, yeah, I sing." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, sing." And she thought, me? I should sing? And he said, yes, sing.
In front of Duke Ellington?
Yes. And this was like 2 o'clock in the morning on a snowy night in Zurich. And so she sang, and he immediately said, I want you to come to the studio too. So he put them all on the train the next day to go to Paris. Wow. And that's when they had these two separate sessions of singing, and Abdullah's made him famous, and hers made her
in the closet,
right.
Or who knows. How did it get lost? I mean, does anyone know?
No, we hear stories like that. Like, there were recent recordings of William Cappell, the great pianist, that were found in Australia when some engineer died, and they went through his trunk of stuff, and they found that. So it could possibly be that, but it just seems a little odd. Perhaps, I don't know. I mean, you could make up any kind of theory.
It does seem to happen a lot in the jazz world. I mean, because, you know,
tapes are lost.
Yeah, tapes are lost. Or they sit in a record company's vault for, like, you know, 30 years.
Right.
Because they were outtakes, you know, from a session of, you know, John Coltrane playing with Miles Davis or something. It's like, you know, we can only use one cut of this.
Right.
So these other 45 cuts were going to...
That must have been what it was. But she has an ethereal voice. She really does. And she still sings. And she engages Carnegie Hall every once in a while to sing, and gets together with Billy Higgins and a lot of the old greats and performs.
Yeah.
But she's never had a real starry
career as a
in the sense that her husband has, who travels virtually all over the world.
Uh-huh. Well, good.
And he's down in South Africa now, setting up schools so that the young kids can really be exposed to great music and in a way that they never were during the apartheid era of South Africa. Right. So he's very dedicated to that.
Yeah, don't want to waste music on the young if you're running a fascist state.
Exactly. Just keep them in line, And both Abdullah and Sadama were flown to South Africa to perform at Mandela's inauguration. Mm. So that was exciting for them. And then she's received great awards down there. They flew her first class. She was so impressed with that. She said, told me she had never flown first class before. And they flew her first class down there to receive this great state award for all that she had done with her music.
Yeah.
So,
great.
Yeah, she's a real special person.
Yeah, excellent.
Sang in Berkeley.
Well, good.
So Sodom B. Benjamin and Abdul Ibram may not be household names for most people here in this country, but they are in certain parts of the world, in Europe and, well, South Africa in particular. So,
yeah.
But they're also part of the interest in doing the book, and my part was to introduce these artists to people that may not have heard of them otherwise.
Yeah.
I mean, in the case of Abdullah and Sodom in particular.
Yeah. It's often the case with musicians. I mean, they find audience, you know, wherever. I mean, it's France. A lot of American jazz musicians have been saved by France, certainly. And, you know, and nowadays with the internet, music is all over the place. I mean, you listen to whatever you want to hear.
And yeah. Abdullah has made a huge number of recordings. He likes to do it very freely and spontaneously. And he has a lot of wonderful live recordings in some of the great listening rooms all around the world. He comes to New York a lot still, and has some terrific recordings out there. So again, we have a little of that music for you to sample at some time.
Yeah, well, good. Yeah, I almost feel like you ought to have a box set, you know, to go along with the book.
Well, there you go. Yeah.
Well, there's the idea.
maybe the second edition.
Well, actually, part of the process I'm going through now with the publisher, you know, we're in post-production phase, which means distribution, and I'm lobbying very heavily, and they seem to be agreeable to really trying to market this book as heavily as they can in Europe, because that's really where the jazz audience is, especially for these artists. Now, it may not be true for every American artist or every artist in the world, but these people, I know Charles Lloyd spends most of his time in the East and in Europe, and so does Abdullah, and Eugene Friesen is on tour with the Winter Consort when he's not solo with his other groups, you know, in Europe a good bit of the time. So, you know, there's a real market for it over there.
To say nothing of Philip Glass and often having the premieres of his works over in Europe.
Yeah.
And when I asked him about it, he said it was money.
Right.
It was just, they were very eager to have these new productions. Whereas
because they'll spend $100,000 to put on a, you know, the premiere of a piece by an amazing composer.
Yeah. And extremely excited to hear the latest coming out of America, whereas he had to fight to get some little space in this country to be able to do it. So he said, I just routinely do my premieres over there. So these people are very well known abroad.
Yeah, right, right. Well, thanks so much for coming in today and helping us, helping them find maybe another audience. So
it's a lot of fun.
And that's Wordplay for this week. We've been celebrating Rare Birds, published by the University of Mississippi Press, or the University Press of Mississippi, by Thomas Raincrow and Nan Watkins. Here's a little Philip Glass on the way out.